Hook us up.
Hook us up. Come on, it's not a bad line. Hook us up. That ought to be our tagline.
I liked it.
Welcome back. Welcome to Make Me Smart.
It.
Hook us up. Hey, everybody. I'm Kyle Risdahl.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to another episode of Make Me Smart. Where, hey, what do you know? Where every week, once again, here we are, just like clockwork, getting smart about tech, the economy, and culture. And of course, you guys always there helping us get smarter, which is why we always say, right here in this very spot, none of us is as smart as all of us.
Right in that very spot.
This is when it happens.
That's right. We're going to do a little something this week, and honestly, on and off the next couple of weeks and months, that kind of goes into a conversation that we had like last year, Molly, was it last year or earlier this year, about whether capitalism basically is working for people. I think of the series that we're going to start on today as sort of an outgrowth of that. It's about the economics of inequality in this society and what it means and maybe conceivably what can be done about it. Lots of parts of it, lots of angles, not just one conversation, I promise you. So as I said, coming up in the next weeks and months, lots of this stuff. There is, in this economy, lots of economic inequality, race, gender, geography, you name it, whole bunch of sources, whole bunch of reasons why, and we're going to get to that today and in the coming weeks and months. We're going to start, though, with CEO compensation, how and why it has gotten so high, especially where it when compared to average worker salary, right? That's the metric. That's sort of the bar against which a lot of the CEO pay stuff is measured. And we're going to talk about that. CEOs, we're talking here making, you know, 1,000 times more than what the average employee of their company they run makes. Has not always been that way. We talked about it a little while ago, right? With Abigail Disney getting all over Bob Iger, who runs her eponymous company, making a gazillion dollars. She called it insane, which is really interesting coming from, you know, a woman who bears the company name, you know?
Yeah, it was remarkable. And I think a lot of what we're going to talk about is, in fact, that ratio, not in the Twitter way, but the ratio, like the difference between what your lowest paid employee makes and what your CEOs make. I just learned, in fact, that the most glaring example of CEO pay is actually Elon Musk, whose total compensation adds up to around $2.3 billion, the biggest yearly salary ever. And that's
we should say most of virtually all of that is options, right? So that's, you know, if
it's
the company
all, right.
goes kerflooey, he gets bupkis.
Which is a huge part of this conversation that we are going to get to, absolutely. But these CEO salaries they are going up at twice the rate of ordinary wages. So that seemed like the most obvious place for us to start when we, in our little mini series here about the economics of inequality. We're going to take a little spin through the history of how we got to this place. And talk about the mechanics that allowed for it to happen. So here to discuss it with us is Heather Boucher. She's the executive director of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. What a concept. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Equitable growth. How do we
it's a little oxymoronic, right?
I don't mean to jump to the end here, but yeah. Like.
Well, it doesn't have to be oxymoronic. We used to grow together. We used to be a country where when the economy grew, people up and down the income spectrum grew. And so we think that the evidence points to the fact that we could do it again. It just requires some big changes in our policy environment.
Give us the elevator pitch history lesson. I mean, because it wasn't always this way, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, when you look over the post-World War II period, you know, kind of going back to the 1950s or 60s, you know, we have this data that we look at each quarter called the gross domestic product. We look at what's happening to our aggregate economy. And one of the things that economists have been doing is attaching actual data on who gains when the economy grows onto those measures of aggregate national income growth to give us a sense of, you know, who's benefiting. And what they found is super fascinating that, you know, between over the 1960s and 70s, when the economy grew, almost everybody in America saw their incomes grow at about the same pace. And in fact, those at the top saw their incomes grow slower than the average. And those at the bottom saw their incomes grow faster. And since about 1980, you've seen the opposite. And in fact, 90% of Americans are seeing their incomes grow slower than the average growth overall. And so much of that is about the things that we want to talk about today, about CEO pay and what's happening at the top. But we used to be a country of equitable growth. We are no longer, but we can really point to what's changed in our society and try to undo those things.
What was it? Well, I mean, what happened in the 1980s? Yeah. You know, was it the...
Was it Ronald
was it
Reagan?
Perhaps
was it
a change in tax rates? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's so many things. Totally happy to go right into that. You know,
yeah,
I mean, it's a big question, but right? I mean, one, certainly taxes change. How we thought about taxes changed, right? And actually, let me take it one step back. It's not any one thing that changed, but a whole set of different ways of thinking about the economy and how markets work that said, you know what, markets work best when they are, quote unquote, left to their own devices. And in fact, anything that we do that supports institutions or that addresses inequality is actually bad for growth. And, you know, we now know decades later that actually what that's done is, you know, we've decreased taxes at the top by significant amount in numerous iterations, you know, culminating, of course, in 2017 with the Trump tax cuts. And we were told that that would lead to stronger, broadly shared growth. And that's not what we've seen. Growth on average has been lower since the 80s than it was in those decades before. And of course, that growth hasn't been shared. We've changed how we think about how big firms can get and whether or not government should make sure that there's competition in the market. And we've deconstructed the institutions that pushed for equitable growth, and first and foremost, unions. You know, there's been a 50-year campaign to, you know, decimate unions in the United States, and it's been successful to the extent that there are fewer people in private sector unions today than there were before we made them legal, or before we made strikes legal back in the 1930s. And those campaigns have really meant that there's no bulwark against rising economic concentration and rising wealth inequality. So, and then, of course, all that plays out into politics. So, I mean, that's just the meta narrative, but a lot right. changed in those decades.
So part of that narrative and part of the aggregation of wealth has gone to the corporate side, right? So you've got much bigger companies now, much more powerful companies with CEOs who have much more oomph in this economy. And for some reason, it has become accepted practice to pay those CEOs certainly at least 1,000 multiples of what the average, you know, Disney park worker makes. Do you agree with the thesis that it's become acceptable somehow? I mean, it kind of has, because it's just kind of kept on going.
It's certainly become the norm, right?
Yeah, and the norm, right.
There's so many things that go into that. But once you've created this culture where it's perfectly acceptable for one CEO to make, you know, so much more than the average worker, and you've got so many of these folks sitting on these interlocking boards, you have different policies that encourage stock options, which, you know, as you sort of already noted with Elon Musk, as being a huge part of his compensation. You know, you had changes in the tax code that encouraged those instead of pay, but so it allowed that to skyrocket a little bit. But, you know, you kind of have to look back to what happened in the 70s and 80s to understand, you know, what changed about those norms. But then moving forward, it's now socially acceptable, right? So now we have these multi-layered problems, right? That, you know, how do you push back on something that's become, so widely, and widely prevalent.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then would it be, it seems to me that CEO pay is one thing by itself, but it's the inequality that has made us start to discuss it. Like, would it be a big deal if Elon Musk made $2.3 billion a year in stock if his lowest paid employee made $150,000?
It's a really interesting question, Molly. And I think, you know, this is one that I think people have been struggling with for the past few decades. It's certainly one, you know, when I came to Washington, I started out a think tank in 2000, and I remember asking one of my colleagues that question. You know, I was started right out of fresh out of graduate school and super excited to be in D.C. and excited to be thinking about these issues, and, you know, was looking to someone who is more experienced in policymaking, and was kind of like, well, yeah, you know, I mean, if we raise the minimum wage, if we focus on boosting, you know, the salaries of middle-class families, should we really care about those at the top? And, you know, the evidence that's come out over the past few decades really does push to the conclusion that if you have this, even if the middle class folks, you know, are perhaps doing okay, as long as you have this extremely high inequality, That has these effects on our economy and on our society and on our political process in ways that make, and you can see this playing out in our economy today, that make it more likely that that kind of high inequality will continue to increase. And then you won't see the kinds of investments in boosting middle-class incomes or investments in goods and services for middle-class and lower-income consumers or any of the other things that are going to drive strong growth moving forward. So I think at this point, the weight of the evidence is, yes, it does really matter if a handful of people are taking home these outsized gains for reasons of economics and also democracy and, you know, the ways that that translates into political and social power.
So let me ask you well, there will be a series, but I'll sprinkle them through the next 6 or 8 minutes. But here's the first of my I'm going to poke you in the eye a little bit questions. And the first one goes like this. There are only a handful of people who can, just to pick on Bob Iger for a minute, right, who can run a company like that, right, who can do what he's done with that company in the last 20 years for the company's shareholders, for the value that consumers get out of ESPN and Pixar and Star Wars and all that good stuff. Why shouldn't he make $56 million a year?
It's a great question. And I think that the answer lies in looking at the economy as a whole system, not necessarily looking at any one individual. So, yeah, I mean, certainly you want to create incentives for people to invest in their own human capital and their own talents and their abilities, get themselves educated, get themselves skills. You want to create opportunities for people to innovate and reap the rewards of that, of their hard work and putting their talent to use. But the challenge comes when, as a society, we allow that process to lead to fewer and fewer people at the top reaping more and more of the gains for themselves, because it closes off opportunity for everybody else, and it subverts and distorts the whole economy. But so let me give you back a data point from a research study that I think is a good counterpoint to this.
Give me a book back. That's what it's all
about. Yeah. So Raj Chetty's was on our steering committee as a founding member, and at our first grantee conference.
Done lots of work. We should say who Raj Chetty is, right? Lots of work on economic inequality and mobility in this society. He's done some foundational work. Anyway. Sorry, go ahead.
Totally. And he came and gave a lunchtime talk at our first conference of all the grantees and folks we support. And this study has since then been made public, but it was this really just super interesting study about how he connected the dots between data on who gets patents, on what their incomes are, what their third grade test scores were in math, what their family income was when they were in third grade. So you know about this person who's got a patent as an adult and their childhood experience. And what he and his colleagues found was, you know, lo and behold, people who did good on third grade math tests more likely to grow up and become innovators, more likely to apply for and receive patents as an adult. Well, that seems totally logical, right? Like, you know, common sense. What he also found is that if you just look at the kids that did well on those third grade tests in math, the children from wealthier families, 4 times as likely to grow up and get patents. So I don't think that there's anything wrong with Bob Iger being able to reap some gains from the fact that he's talented. But I really want all of those other talented people to also be able to enter the economy. And I want all of us to benefit from their talents as well. So we have to really investigate what goes wrong, why some people aren't able to move up the ladder, and the extent to which that is because concentrated economic resources leads to distortions and subversions of our economy because that affects our politics and our society. And you don't really have to look further than recent headlines to see the way that wealthy elites have decided that their kids don't need to be meritorious to get into college. They can buy their way in. That offends so many different things. But what it fundamentally says is that if you allow some people to garner more and more in the gains, they are going to make sure that they and their children hold on to those gains. And that will, and it is, stifling innovation, and it's stifling productivity, and it's stifling growth.
So now I think not to toot our own horn, but we're at least having this conversation. We're having this, but we're having this conversation because Abigail Disney started this. This is happening. People are starting to discuss this. There are conversations about whether CEO pay is too far out of line with average worker pay. However, despite the power of the argument that you make, if I'm Bob Iger, I'm still like, yeah, not my problem. You know, so I wonder when you're facing an entrenchment that has already happened, what is the argument that you can make to the sort of CEO class, right, or the boards or the shareholders in these public companies that says we're going to have to lower this CEO pay, or worse, you're the new baby CEO and you just don't get paid as much because we are trying to make a more equitable society?
That, and therein lies the question underlying so much of American politics. You know, you have seen wealthy elites come to the table and say, we do need to do wealth taxes. We do need to start thinking mm-hmm. about this. And that's been very exciting to see people stand up and say, this is important. I actually think in the conversations that I've had with folks at the top end of the income spectrum, you know, the idea that the smart children of tomorrow should be able to move their way up, I do think is a compelling one, because it's about what we believe in as a society. It's about the fact that we think that what makes American capitalism so great and has made it so vibrant is that it provides this opportunity for innovation and for good ideas to bubble up. So I think we can tap into that. We can tap into this idea of patriotism, that if we want the United States to be a strong economy in 10, 20, 30, you know, 40, 50 years at the end of this century, this is the most important economic issue that we're going to have to confront, because otherwise we're going to become a stale, some kind of aristocracy. I don't know what we'll call it, but that it's calcifying wealth in ways that isn't going to be good for all of us.
So here we have, just to round it out, right, and sort of look to the future, here we have, we're on the cusp of the 2020 campaign, deep into the cusp, I suppose. You've got Elizabeth Warren, right, on the Democratic side talking about this. You've got Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side talking about this. Is there, beyond a political stump speech, is there actually an organized movement or a chance for change on this, do you believe?
I'm an economist, and I'm not. Yeah. So I shouldn't be, you know, making predictions about politics. What do I know? You know, an economist, we're terrible at forecasting, right? That's what they say. I mean, what I have been seeing, you know, building over the past few decades. So I'll point to a few things. One is that you see an increasing awareness among economists that inequality matters for how the economy works. So you see so many scholars who are now seeking to understand the ways that inequality actually affects our understanding of how firms work, how how we think about both the production side and the distribution side, what it means for macroeconomic outcomes and therefore macroeconomic policymaking. So you're seeing people really take that seriously and coming to the consensus that, wow, it does matter and it is having this distortionary effect. So that gives me some hope that there's a lot of evidence about the effects of inequality and high pay for some. You're also seeing the emerging generation that we've been connecting with at Equitable Growth of thought leaders who are doing econ policy who are asking this question as well and asking, well, what is it that we can do on the policy side? Hmm. Now, on the advocacy and politics side, I mean, this has been bubbling up for decades, right? Occupy was about, you know, the 99% versus the 1%, you know, quoting, you know, Piketty and Saez's research in this,
sure.
This way, which was, you know, as an economist, very exciting to see data points making it out there into the public discourse. But, you know, you're also seeing the frustration, right? You know, when you look into how people understood the 2016 election and how people are thinking about voters' views, this frustration with an economy that doesn't deliver, which is real, which shows up in the data, and that they want people to do something, politicians aren't going to be able to get around that.
Right. It sounds like ultimately you're saying it has to become sort of culturally entrenched. And maybe it's not fair to say Bob Iger is sitting there saying it's not my problem. Maybe, you know, these people are smart enough to realize that it should be their problem and that they just don't necessarily need to be grossly wealthy. Maybe there will become a new norm where people say, ooh, I have too much money. That's kind of embarrassing. Hope springs eternal.
Yeah. Hope springs eternal, but it will require political action. So,
Heather Boucher is the executive director of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. I will never get over loving that. Heather, thank you so much for the time.
Heather, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, there we go.
Outstanding. Also a good place to note that the United States has just scored. It's 2-1.
Ah, well, there we go.
In the Women's World Cup.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice to know.
Just a quick follow-up before we go into
our
fixations.
That's right. We got the soccer thing. So there was installment one, actually, of, you know, economic inequality in this society. So if you are either a CEO, if you're Bob Iger, call us. But if you're any other kind of CEO or a worker who's interested in this, drop us a line. Let us know. Send us a voicemail.
Yeah.
It's makemesmart@marketplace.org.
That's such a great point. Like, I really want to know what Elon Musk 2.0 is thinking, right? Like, who is the hot startup CEO who's saying, I'm going to make my compensation dependent on other things, or I'm going to set a moral cap.
Those people are out there, for sure. Yeah.
They're definitely out there, and they're probably younger than Bob Iger. But, you know, call us.
Yes.
MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org, like Kai said. Time for a break, and then our thoughts.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
It was a little tricky this week since I'm not there. All right, we're back. I don't know if I got the timing right or not, but I guess we'll fix it in post, as they say.
We'll fix it in post. I know, we talk about it, and then people hear it, and they're like, I don't understand.
It was fine. You guys shut up. I don't know what
you're talking
about. all right, you go first. And, look, you have one. And only one, I should say.
I do, and I have only one. I'm working on it. I'm going to turn this ship around.
I'm so proud of you.
I went to... In highly unexpected development in my career as a mostly technology business journalist, I went to a sustainability conference last week. And it was, because we're doing this series on climate change and adaptation. And I learned that just in the last year or two, there has been a really big corporate oversight change. Like that companies used to have governance goals, just governance goals. And that in the last year or two, environmental and sustainability goals have been added to governance so that there's this metric called ESG that companies have to meet with their board members and shareholders and all of that and with certification boards, and that has led to, and this should totally be a marketplace feature, I think it's really interesting, that's led to a whole lot of new openings for chief sustainability officer roles.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of like didn't used to exist anymore, or didn't used to exist at a really high level. And I think that's a fascinating labor story. But then, relevant to our conversation today, I found this article from just today in the Wall Street Journal about how some companies are actually linking executive pay to sustainability targets. And so they're saying that if you don't make progress against these ESG goals, you won't get your full bonus. You won't get paid.
Hmm.
And in this sort of ongoing conversation about like how to tackle climate change and what are the incentives and what are the economic drivers, I thought that was super interesting. And of course, highly relevant to today's discussion.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yep. Look, this stuff matters and people are beginning to realize it. That's actually what's going on here, right? And
they really are. And if you're going to have crazy, CEO pay, then at least say your pay isn't going to be that crazy unless you are meaningfully reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Just as one example.
Yep. Just to, save the planet. All right. So mine is, I'm keying off a column in the Financial Times about the Federal Reserve. But really, I want to point out two things. At the end of this week, we will be in, we will be tied for the longest peacetime expansion in the history of the American economy since 1850 and something, which is 10 years, 120 months come the end of this week, which is kind of amazing given all that has been going on the past 10 years. I mean, part of it was recovery from the Great Recession, yes, but then there has been, shall we say, political turmoil in this country. There has been regulatory change. There's been all kinds of stuff going on, which has been totally fascinating. But the other thing I want to talk about, and the reason I'm commending this article to you, is that it's actually a column. It's not an article. By Rana Furuhar. She writes for the Financial Times. And she points out something that is actually true, that the Federal Reserve now, as it turns to lowering interest rates instead of raising them, seemingly on the turn of a dime, has over the past generation or so done a lot to make economic expansions last longer. And her point is that sometimes a continually expanding economy is not necessarily the best thing. You need a little, just like in wildfire management, if I could, you know, make an unfortunate comparison, you need to clean out the underbrush every now and then. And that sometimes is what recessions can do. And the Fed has been changing the way it's managing this economy from, you know, strictly fixating on its dual mandate of price stability and maximum employment to, oh, let's keep the expansion going, which is exactly what Jay Powell said at his last press conference. He said, we're going to do whatever we have to do, in essence, to keep the expansion going. So anyway, that's that. Congratulations, 10-year economic boom, and we'll see what happens.
That's
there we go.
That is super interesting. And relates, or could relate to this conversation too, which is like, here we are in a long expansion that not everyone is feeling.
Yep.
And,
oh, yeah, for sure. Still.
And if there were a recession, the question is, would it hurt the same people who have not yet felt the expansion? Or would it clear out some of the underbrush of, say, inflated CEO pay or gigantic companies that are, you know, so unsustainably large that they would just tip over under their own weight?
I'm going to spoiler alert.
You're going dark place, aren't you?
Spoiler alert.
Here it comes.
Already. I'm not going there. It's there. The people who will be hurt by the next recession are the same people who were hurt by the Great Recession. And no, it will not cut Bob Iger's pay. Not to keep picking on Bob Iger, but you know. I reject that application of the dark place thing. I reject it fully.
Well, look, some companies go out of business. I mean, I was here in the .com. I've been recently obsessed with the .com bust in 2001, 2002. I mean, that cleared out a lot of companies that didn't have good business models.
Yes.
Like if we didn't have, easy access to capital were not enabling somebody like Uber to raise however many hundreds of billions of dollars of private money, then maybe, you're right.
Sorry,
then all those employees would just get fired. And
I just have to look up
Travis
the stock ticker here for a minute. I will point out that Petco went under because Petco was a terrible business model, right? Right? There was nothing. There was no there. I will also now point out that a company named Chewy has recently gone public and is worth something like, I can't even figure out what it is here. Ridiculous Enthusiasm is the headline. So, you know.
About Chewy? That's ridiculous. Yeah.
Look, I'm just saying.
I'm not saying there's not a bubble. I'm just saying Chewy is a good business.
Yeah.
I really like how they bring me my dog.
Shall we?
Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Your
what
turn.
Are we doing?
Hi, Kai and Molly.
Oh, my God.
This is Brent from Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right. Down with that. Lots of feedback on our facial recognition episode last week. Daniel Wright from Oakland, California. He sent this. Here you go.
And I remember back when I first found out that my cell phone was tracking everything I did. I was horrified and then, you know, turned off the tracking apps and all that stuff for a year. And then at some point I was just like, whatever, they're going to find me if they want to find me. And I think that facial recognition is going to be the same thing. I just don't know if we're not just a bunch of frogs getting boiled slowly.
Ribbit. That's what I think.
I had that thing happen recently with a friend where we had a conversation in the back of a Lyft about a product, and then immediately the next day that product showed up in an ad in his Instagram, and he was like, "I haven't searched for this." We just had a conversation, and nobody hasn't had this happen, right? Like you can't tell
me I haven't had that happen.
That really?
Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Man, I've had it happen. And this was so stark. I mean, it was literally like, I only ever buy these. I like to buy these Richardson hats. I haven't bought one in like 10 years. And literally the next day it shows up in the Instagram feed. And I'm like, come on. Like, we're not even getting boiled slowly. We're at a fast clip.
Fire it up. Put them in the microwave. All right. Anyway, sorry. Unfortunate image. You go next. Dallas.
Kelly Clark Martin from Orlando, Florida, said she thinks it's interesting that San Francisco is the first place to ban facial recognition and that it may be no accident, actually.
It seems as though people in San Francisco, due to the proximity to Silicon Valley, would be probably the most aware of the possible side effects and harm of this technology, and yet they're also the first people to ban it, almost as though they're saying it's good enough for other people, but we don't want it here.
Well, yes. Well, also, San Francisco is politically liberal and progressive, and, you know, there's that.
Well, right? And also San Francisco's lawmakers, I think, have felt like that. Right. It's more that San Francisco's lawmakers have freaking had enough with the with the excesses of the valley. But you do raise a good point, which is that, like, a lot of these schools, a lot of these private schools that and charter schools that the valley has funded for themselves have way less technology in them. You know, so there are certainly some of the realizations about the harms are coming faster. But I think if anything, you could say that this is more of a reaction to the tech industry being next door by the lawmakers who are like, enough.
Yeah, there is some cognitive dissonance there with Silicon Valley. I'll tell you that. All right. Imuns Mosseni is worried about facial recognition hitting the market in a bigger way. Here you go.
There have been lots and lots of data breaches these past few years. These companies and agencies that had data stolen, a lot of them sometimes reassure us by telling us that most of what was stolen was encrypted. Well, it was stolen, and once quantum computing is out there, I'm betting that most of these folks weren't using quantum-resistant encryption.
I'm not taking that bet, because it's almost certainly true that they were not using quantum-resistant encryption. Yes? Yes.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So all those stolen troves. Man, I have to say that I did not even consider this. The existing stolen troves of data that have been unlockable so far, and master keys are getting built right now.
For sure.
That's a freaking bummer.
All right. The Make Me Smart question is next, I believe, Ms. Wood. Yes?
Oh, Lord. Sorry. I'm just contemplating the darkness. Yes. Time for the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Neal Stephenson is one of my favorites. I'm not going to lie. Sci-fi writer and author. And he has a new book out called Fall that is essentially about the horrors of social media and the end of death in typical Neal Stephenson fashion.
End
this
of
shouldn't
death?
Come as a surprise. Yeah. Right. Like digitally uploading your consciousness so that death kind of goes away, and then what happens, and then the mind body problem. It's really, you should read, you might like it. It's really good. Anyway, I mentioned in last week's show that I was reading the book, and that's because we're interviewing him on Marketplace Tech tomorrow. And while he was on the line, of course, we asked him the Make Me Smart question, and here's his answer.
One thing that I used to assume is that people actually believed in what they said they believed in. Which seems kind of obvious, but people, you know, said that they were a libertarian or a Christian or a conservative or what have you, that actually meant that they had a body of beliefs that they actually did believe in, and that you could have conversations with them on that basis. And now I don't think that anymore. Now I think it's more that those are just signifiers of tribal identification. It's like being a Bears fan versus being a Packers fan. And so facts and argument have absolutely nothing to do with it.
I think that is 1,000% true. Sign me up for that one.
Yep. Yep. Right? Agreed.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
You full can hear that, tomorrow, that interview. Yes.
Yep. There you go. Actually, it's a two-parter. So today and tomorrow, Monday and Tuesday. Yes. Because much like a Neal Stephenson book, which is 1,000 pages long, there was too much in there for just one piece.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Also, don't forget the newsletter, people. Don't forget the newsletter. Sign up at marketplace.org/newsletters. It's really, really good, actually. You totally learn stuff, which I just think is awesome. Yeah, totally.
Marketplace.org/newsletters is where you find that.
Did I not say that? Sorry.
I don't know. I'm just going to say it again. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Our senior producer is Eve Tro. And thank you to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore. Special thanks this week to Jody Becker, sitting in the producer chair.
Totally true. Video done this week, by the way. Also, audio in New York, where I am, by Sarah Begare, because I'm traveling and I'm not there. This week's program, I'm Just Going to Take It on Faith, was engineered by Jake Orski. I can't see him. Theme music composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is one Deborah Clark.
Hi, Deb.
Thanks for listening.
Just testing. Just testing.
Wondering. We crack us up.
USA. USA. USA.
Yeah, we had
Spider
Hole
Bummer discussion. We're pretty close. It's they've gotten plus four.
Okay.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.